ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। सो वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भगवद गीता एज इट इज चैप्टर 14 कॉल्ड थ्री मोड्स ऑफ मटेरियल नेचर एंड टेक्स्ट नंबर 11। इज दैट राइट? वी कवर्ड टिल 10 लास्ट टाइम। Okay, so let's read the verses 11 through 18. We can all read the verses together, and I'll read the translation on my own. So starting with text 11 on page 691, and we go to text number 18. Sarvadvareshu dehismin prakasha upajayate ज्ञानं यदा तदा विद्याद् विविद्धं सत्त्वमित्युत। The manifestations of the mode of goodness can be experienced when all the gates of the body are illuminated by knowledge. लोभ प्रवृत्तिरारंभ कर्मणाम शमस्प्रिह रजस्येतानि जायन्ते विविद्धे भरतर्षभा। O chief of the Bharatas, when there is an increase in the mode of passion, the symptoms of great attachment, fruitive activity, intense endeavor, and uncontrollable desire and hankering develop. Aprakasho pravittischa प्रमादो मोह एव च तमस्येतानि जायन्ते विविद्धे कुरु नन्दन। When there is an increase in the mode of ignorance, O son of Kuru, darkness, inertia, madness and illusion are manifested. यदा सत्वे प्रवृद्धे तु प्रलयं याति देहभृत् तदोत्तमविदां लोकान् अमलान् प्रतिपद्यते। When one dies in the mode of goodness, he attains to the pure higher planets of the great sages. रजसि प्रलयं गत्वा कर्मसंगिषु जायते तथा प्रलिनस्तमसि मूढयोनिषु जायते। When one dies in the mode of passion, he takes birth among those engaged in fruitive activities. And when one dies in the mode of ignorance, he takes birth in the animal kingdom. Karmana sukritasyahu sattvikam nirmalam phalam rajasastu phalam dukkham ajnanam tamasa phalam. The result of pious action is pure and is said to be in the mode of goodness. But action done in the mode of passion results in misery, and action performed in the mode of ignorance results in foolishness. Sattvat sanjayate jnanam rajaso lobha eva cha pramada mohau tamaso bhavato jnanam eva cha. From the mode of goodness, real knowledge develops. From the mode of passion, greed develops. And from the mode of ignorance, develop foolishness, madness and illusion. Urdhvam gacchanti sattvastha madhye tishthanti rajasa jaganya guna vrittistha adho gacchanti tamasa. those situated in the mode of goodness gradually go upward to the higher planets. Those in the mode of passion live on the earthly planets. And those in the abominable mode of ignorance go down to the hellish worlds. So let's read two purports. One for text number 16 and the other for 17. So text number 16 on page 695. The translation again. The result of pious action is pure and is said to be in the mode of goodness. But action done in the mode of passion results in misery, and action performed in the mode of ignorance results in foolishness. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai. The result of pious activities in the mode of goodness is pure. Therefore the sages, who are free from all illusion, are situated in happiness. But activities in the mode of passion are simply miserable. Any activity for material happiness is bound to be defeated. If, for example, one wants to have a skyscraper, so much human misery has to be undergone before a big skyscraper can be built. The financier has to take much trouble to earn a massive wealth, and those who are slaving to construct the building have to render physical toil. The miseries are there. Thus, Bhagavad Gita says that in any activity performed under the spell of the mode of passion, there is definitely great misery. There may be a little so-called mental happiness. I have this house or this money. But this is not actual happiness. As far as the mode of ignorance is concerned, the performer is without knowledge, and therefore all his activities result in present misery, and afterwards he will go on toward animal life. Animal life is always miserable, although under the spell of the illusory energy, Maya, the animals do not understand this. Slaughtering poor animals is also due to the mode of ignorance. The animal killers do not know that in the future the animal will have a body suitable to kill them. That is the law of nature. In human society, if one kills a man, he has to be hanged. That is the law of the state. Because of ignorance, people do not perceive that there is a complete state controlled by the Supreme Lord. Every living creature is a son of the Supreme Lord, and he does not tolerate even an ant's being killed. One has to pay for it. So indulgence in animal killing for the taste of the tongue is the grossest kind of ignorance. A human being has no need to kill animals because God has supplied so many nice things. If one indulges in meat eating anyway, it is to be understood that he is acting in ignorance and is making his future very dark. Of all kinds of animal killing, the killing of cows is most vicious, because the cow gives us all kinds of pleasure by supplying milk. Cow slaughter is an act of the grossest type of ignorance. In the Vedic literature, Rig Veda 9.4.64, the words Gobhi Prinita Matsaram indicate that one who, being fully satisfied by milk, is desirous of killing the cow, is in the grossest ignorance. There is also a prayer in the Vedic literature that states, Namo Brahmanya Devaya Go Brahmana Hitaya Cha Jagadhitaya Krishnaya Govindaya Namo Nama. My Lord, you are the well-wisher of the cows and the Brahmanas, and you are the well-wisher of the entire human society and world. Vishnu Puran 1.19.65. The purport is that special mention is given in that prayer for the protection of the cows and the Brahmanas. Brahmanas are the symbol of spiritual education, and cows are the symbol of the most valuable food. These two living creatures, the Brahmanas and the cows, must be given all protection. That is real advancement of civilization. In modern human society, spiritual knowledge is neglected and cow killing is encouraged. It is to be understood then that human society is advancing in the wrong direction and is clearing the path to its own condemnation. A civilization which guides the citizens to become animals in their next lives is certainly not a human civilization. The present human civilization is, of course, grossly misled by the modes of passion and ignorance. It is a very dangerous age, and all nations should take care to provide the easiest process, Krishna consciousness, to save humanity from the greatest danger. And the next verse. From the mode of goodness, real knowledge develops. From the mode of passion, greed develops, and from the mode of ignorance develop foolishness, madness, and illusion. Purport. Since the present civilization is not very congenial to the living entities, Krishna consciousness is recommended. Through Krishna consciousness, society will develop the mode of goodness. When the mode of goodness is developed, people will see things as they are. In the mode of ignorance, people are just like animals and cannot see things clearly. In the mode of ignorance, for example, they do not see that by killing one animal, they are taking the chance of being killed by the same animal in the next life. Because people have no education and actual knowledge, they become irresponsible. To stop this irresponsibility, education for developing the mode of goodness of the people in general must be there. When they are actually educated in the mode of goodness, they will become sober, in full knowledge of things as they are. Then people will be happy and prosperous. Even if the majority of the people aren't happy and prosperous, if a certain percentage of the population develops Krishna consciousness and becomes situated in the mode of goodness, then there is the possibility of peace and prosperity all over the world. Otherwise, if the world is devoted to the modes of passion and ignorance, there can be no peace or prosperity. In the mode of passion, people become greedy and their hankering for sense enjoyment has no limit. One can see that even if one has enough money and adequate arrangements for sense gratification, there is neither happiness nor peace of mind. That is not possible because one is situated in the mode of passion. If one wants happiness at all, his money will not help him. He has to elevate himself to the mode of goodness by practicing Krishna consciousness. When one is engaged in the mode of passion, not only is he mentally unhappy, but his profession and occupation are also very troublesome. He has to devise so many plans and schemes to acquire enough money to maintain his status quo. This is all miserable. In the mode of ignorance, people become mad. Being distressed by their circumstances, they take shelter of intoxication, and thus they sink further into ignorance. Their future in life is very dark. Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langhayate Girim Yat Kripatamaham Vande Shri Gurum Dinataranam Paramanandamadhamam. Can I borrow someone's watch? Can I borrow someone's watch? Which thing? The right? Okay. So, I guess you've already covered in the first 10 verses of this chapter the basics of the three modes of material nature. Is that correct? You have a basic idea of the three modes? And the whole chapter, of course, is called the three modes of material nature. So it's all on this subject. And it's not a very long chapter. But based on your previous knowledge, can anyone just define what are the three modes of nature? What are they fundamentally? What do we mean when we say the three modes of nature? Yes, these are the three modes, goodness, passion. But I mean to say what are goodness, passion, ignorance? In other words, what are the can you say something general about the three modes of nature? Well, what are they? What do they do? What's the purpose? What's the point?
Sleeping 10 to 12 hours.
That's the mode of?
Ignorance.
Okay. So, okay, we can specify these three individually rather than saying something general. So, mode of ignorance means sleeping and lethargy, sloth, intoxication, madness, dullness, dull-headedness, mode of ignorance, sleeping too much. Eating too much. I don't know. Mode of passion, maybe. Yeah, what's the mode of passion? Yeah, in some sense, creativity. Fruitive activity. Fruitive activity means doing your actions for their results, right? So I do this because I need this. Sense gratification. Trying to, endeavoring, hankering to satisfy the senses. What else?
Extraneous endeavor.
Yeah, extraneous endeavor or over endeavor, more endeavor than necessary to keep the body and soul together. What's the single most defining quality of the mode of passion?
Hankering.
Yeah, or in other words, another common word used for hankering?
Desire.
Hmm?
Desire.
Desire. And another word? A particular type of desire? Basically the same thing as hankering. Lust. It's not everything there is to the mode of passion, but it's the defining quality. Kind of. And lust in a very broad sense of the term, meaning the hankering or the desire for any kind of sense gratification, right? Kind of brings the idea together. And mode of goodness?
Knowledge.
Happiness.
Peacefulness.
Seeing things as they are, as is result of knowledge. Satisfaction, being satisfied.
Happiness,
peacefulness. These three modes of nature, in essence, they're fundamentally, if we were to try to define them, what they are, then they are the stuff of which this universe is made. They're the fundamental building blocks of this material world. So like in physics or chemistry, we deconstruct things all the way down to their fundamental building blocks, the elements, and we have a periodic table of elements and atoms and molecules. Physics continuously tries to break down things to get to their most fundamental. What's the most fundamental? So you think, okay, it's atoms, right? And you break down the atoms and you get protons and neutrons and electrons. And then now they have what? Quarks and what is it? Different things. Photons.
What glues the
a gluon. Yeah. So the idea is you get to the most fundamental building block as much as possible, right? Smaller and smaller. And ultimately they say, well, it's actually all energy. The matter is convertible to energy. And it's the same thing, particles of energy. But according to the Vedas, yes, that's true. You can, you know, divide the matter up as much as you want. But fundamentally, actually, ultimately, below everything, this whole cosmic manifestation is made actually, at its most basis, made of the three modes of material nature. It's literally the stuff which constitutes this world. So everything around us, not just our personalities or our character, but even physical objects, stones, trees, the sky, everything, the sun, the moon, everything is just a combination of these three modes of material nature. In the beginning of creation, these three modes of material nature, they're present as one homogeneous blob, and they're in equilibrium. The three modes of nature are in, you can say, in equal tension, and they're kind of peacefully lying there. And at some point then, and the living entities are within these modes of material nature, they're in kind of the womb of the material nature. So this womb is made of the three modes of nature, and the living entities are somewhere there. And everything is kind of peaceful, it's kind of in equilibrium. And then the Supreme Lord, he glances upon this homogeneous blob of material nature, the three modes of material nature. And by his glance, the equilibrium of these three modes is destroyed. And suddenly, these three modes start competing with each other. They start fighting and vying for supremacy. So in verse 10 you read last time, Krishna says, sometimes the mode of goodness becomes prominent, defeating the modes of passion and ignorance. Sometimes the mode of passion defeats goodness and ignorance, and at other times, ignorance defeats goodness and passion. In this way, there's always competition for supremacy. So all these modes of nature are fighting with each other and hoping. So this mess up of equilibrium is caused by the glance of the Lord. That glance causes the material energy to become agitated. And by this glance, the factor of time is introduced. Time is like the spoon by which you use to stir the pot. So you have this pot of the three modes of material nature, and it's kind of peacefully sitting there. Everything's in proper equilibrium. And then the Supreme Lord, he takes the spoon of time, the ladle, and he swirls it up. And everything becomes all agitated. He turns the heat on, and starts boiling. And when this happens, then the living entities, they awake. And they remember all the desires they had and all the qualities they had acquired from these three modes of material nature. These desires then lead them, they pull them, to take on particular material bodies. Even these material bodies that the living entities take are a combination of the three modes of nature. So the bodies of animals, we're hearing here, are composed largely of the mode of ignorance, because there's no light of knowledge there. They're driven by their instincts. They're driven by their circumstances, by their desires. They don't have the ability to stop and think, to question, to reflexively look upon themselves and say, why am I here? What's my purpose in this world? Whereas, like the human form of body is very much a product of the mode of passion. We're active beings. We like to do things. This is the human planet is a planet of activity, karma bhumi. And other species of life, especially the higher planets, the demigods, are predominantly in the mode of goodness. And they're very peaceful and very situated, full of knowledge. They can see things as they are. Their vision is much broader than us. But even individually on this planet, if we look at amongst ourselves, then we find different people are composed of different modes of nature. They have different natures, different qualities. So you find some people who are... Who you can tell, you can look at their physique, you can look at the way they speak, you can look at their nature, and they're very much, down to earth, heavy set, grounded people, and they like to eat, and they like to drink, and they like to have a good life, and that's it. They're happy like that. This is their concept of happiness, just eating, drinking, and a really robust life, that's okay. It's in the mode of passion. This is happiness in the mode of passion. But others, if you just give them good food and a good drink and wine, red wine and champagne like that, they're not satisfied by that. That doesn't satisfy them. They want something heady. They want something. They want to sit around a good meal and discuss points of philosophy, like in Europe, the Vienna Circle, and all these intelligent people coming to the French are famous for that, right? They come to all these. Intelligent people come to France and develop little societies and discuss the meaning of life and the world and become philosophers and philosophers of politics and all these this type of heady knowledge, and they enjoy this. So they're in the mode of goodness. They for their happiness, for their satisfaction, they need that kind of stimulation. Whereas others, neither the good food and the drink and the passion, nor this intelligence, that neither of them are attractive to them. There you can see it just completely living life with their eyes closed, basically. They work hard, get enough money to buy a bottle and drink and sit in front of the TV at home and just vegetate. And this is for them. This is happiness. You say, come on, let's play a game of golf, or let's go sporting or something. Let's go rafting, and they can't even do that. They can't get themselves off the sofa to do that. What to speak of? Let's go discuss some philosophy, or let's go read a good book. Impossible. The TV is fundamentally made for people in the mode of ignorance. It's a medium of the mode of ignorance. Books, on the other hand, are mode of goodness. Books require the intellect to work. They require imagination. They require the mind to work. I don't know, computer, maybe a mode of passion?
It's difficult to say.
It depends if you watch videos on the computer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you're watching TV on the computer, the same thing. On the other hand, if you're logging on to Krishna.com every day, this could be in the mode of goodness, perhaps transcendental. And radio, they say something in between books and TV. It requires some imagination. It's not completely, kind of spoon-fed to you. It's not completely. You're not just a passive observer. You require some thinking. You know, you have to imagine the situation at least. Everything you look in this world, every object in this world is a combination of these three modes of nature. And if you study Krishna's classification of the modes of nature in this chapter and also in the 18th chapter, he continues also in the other chapters. If you read them carefully and you study them and you try to apply them, then you actually see, you look around and you see the world in terms of these three modes of nature. You see very clearly how what Krishna is saying actually works. The whole world is being pulled by these modes. It's like Ganapati Swami, when he was here many years ago, he said one of the realizations he got as a result of distributing books all over the United States, go to different college campuses and distribute books. And he said, you can very clearly see how people are being pulled by these three modes of nature. You can see the whole Bhagavad Gita being played out before you. When someone, you say, you stop someone to come to the table, you know, hand them a card or something, and their reaction to your invitation and to your showing the book, he said, is a textbook case of the way the three modes of material nature work. You can see that they're being pulled in different directions. You can see, like people often say, you know, I'm independent, I have free will, I think for my own, and I decide, you know. But he said, actually, if you look at these people, you can see that they're being pulled. And they're not, the individual is there, but he's being pulled in different directions. He thinks he's doing this independently. That he comes, there's something that attracts him to come. He says, there's something very pure, something very nice about this. And that attracts that person to look through the book and everything. But then there's other tugs also that are pulling. And he's looking at his watch and saying, oh my God, I have time for class or whatever. Or he sees some other distraction go by. Or he says some friend comes. And he says, if a friend comes and pats him on the back, then it's finished. The guy's gone. He's not going to take a book. Because there's enough of a pull there from the mode of passion or from the mode of ignorance or whatever, that his mind is not able to stay fixed on the mode of goodness. So this is the point in the last verse, verse 10. They're all fighting the modes of goodness, passion, ignorance. And you can see that in an individual. There is some goodness there by which he's trying to react and trying to appreciate knowledge. You show them the Bhagavad Gita and they appreciate this is a book of knowledge. Right? This is a book for someone who's advanced in the mode of goodness. But the mode of goodness is so weak in them that they can't focus long enough to actually take benefit from it. It's immediately, there's a rise of the mode of goodness and it's immediately smashed down by the mode of passion or by the mode of ignorance. So it's these three modes of nature, they're a reality which pervade everything around us. And when we realize this fact, when we realize that actually every living entity is being pulled by these three modes of nature according to the nature. See, each of us has received a certain combination of these three modes of nature upon our birth or bringing in from our previous lives. When we are born, we receive a type of body that is a certain combination of the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. And in reality, there's actually very little you can do about changing that. If someone is born with a particular type of passionate nature, then it's very difficult for that person to maintain the mode of goodness for very long. If someone is born mode of goodness, then so these spiritual activities become very easy, very natural. Krishna says this in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. There's a
It's a nice verse. Page 200. That's text 33 in chapter 3. Krishna says, even a man of knowledge acts according to his own nature. For everyone follows the nature he has acquired from the three modes of nature. What can repression accomplish? Krishna is saying, even one who has knowledge, suppose you read Bhagavad Gita and you understand how these three modes of nature work, so your eyes are opened. Even a person who possesses this knowledge is still, to a large degree, forced to act according to the nature he's acquired by the three modes. So Krishna is saying, what will repression accomplish? How can you actually stop a person, or how can you repress your own nature? It's something we receive, and we're pulled by this nature. There's that famous painting of the two men working, and the three modes of material nature personified as three ladies pulling them with different strings. You've seen that on the cover of Laws of Nature? And they've got different strings, and they're controlling these two people. One of these persons is a menial worker. He's shoveling something, and the other guy is ordering him. He's standing on top and making him do that. So the person who's working, he's thinking, I have to work for this man. I'm being ordered. I'm a servant. And the man who is ordering him, he's thinking, I'm the master. I'm controlling this man. I'm the controller. But what they both don't realize is both of them are in fact puppets in the hands of these three ladies. The mode of goodness, the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance. And both are being controlled by them. So neither of them is independent. Each one is being driven. There are people whose nature it is to control. It is their nature to be managers, to be leaders. And it doesn't matter what you do to them. In any situation they enter, they immediately take control of the situation. And people give them control. I don't know if you met people like that. If they walk into a room, then immediately they survey the room, they find out what's happening, and they start organizing things. Say, okay, you do this, this is the situation, you do this, you do this. And everyone listens. Everyone says, yes, they'll do it, even though they might not know the person. Because he's a natural manager, he's a natural leader. He has this quality of leadership. Krishna describes this as one of the qualities of the Kshatriya. Is this quality, Ishwara Bhava. He has this quality of being the controller. And even if they try to not do that, to sit in the back row, somehow everyone automatically defers to them. What do you think we should do? There are others who even if they try to manage the situation, they cannot manage it. They go into a situation, they try to organize people, and they just don't have the charisma to do it. No one listens to them. Some people, you see leaders in the history of the world, right? Great military leaders, they say, let's go this direction, this is what we should do, and they march off in one direction, and the whole world marches behind them. Yes, we should do this. And there's other people, when they march off in a particular direction, and they look around, no one's following them. I don't know where he went. You know, it's not their nature. They don't have that nature of controlling, of being leadership. But they might go into a particular circumstance, and they can immediately start analyzing things. They immediately start understanding things. And when they speak, people listen to them. They think, wow, this is a person of knowledge. He's speaking with knowledge. So although he cannot manage them, but he can lead in a different way by his spiritual knowledge. And everyone automatically becomes quiet and they listen. And you see people like that also. There'll be some discussion, some argument going on. And then such a person speaks up, and immediately everyone goes quiet, and they all listen. So what does he have to say? Obviously he's got something deep to say. So like that, mode of goodness. A person is very thoughtful, thinking like that. So different people, we have these different qualities. And none of us are wholly or solely made of one mode. We've all got these three modes, and they're all fighting amongst us. At times we display different qualities in different ways. Sometimes we're more passionate, sometimes. For at least 6 hours every night we're in the mode of ignorance. And we display the mode of ignorance in all its grandeur and beauty. At some point of the day, most of the day, we're in the mode of passion actually. Working hard, you know, making plans, scheming, thinking what to do. We're absorbed in this mode of passion. And mode of goodness, then sometimes in the day, we come to the temple, in the morning time we spend our time in our sadhana, we're chanting our rounds, and we feel peaceful, we feel very satisfied, we think we understand the way the world works, mode of goodness. So these modes are all fighting with inside us, each other. And depending on what mode we cultivate, what circumstances we give ourselves, a particular mode will become stronger. We can feed a mode. We can make it healthier. So we can spend our time, if we spend our time in spiritual activities, the mode of goodness becomes very strong. And even while we're engaged in passionate activities, the mode of goodness will always be there and will be reminding us, don't get too passionate, don't hanker too much after the results of your activities. Remember what the purpose is. The mode of passion will always be present. On the other hand, if we simply feed the mode of passion, then we become workaholics. Work, achieve, achieve, work, achieve. Most of the people like this, top executives of companies, CEOs, very powerful people, leaders of the world, they're very, very passionate people, working 14, 16 hours a day. But they enjoy it. This is happiness for them. Each mode of nature has its own quality of happiness. Each mode of nature is satisfying to the person who's controlled by that mode. So the person who's in the mode of ignorance, he's completely intoxicated, drunk on the street. He's thinking he's happy. There's no troubles, he's fully satisfied. He's relaxed. So, well, what's the problem, mate? I'm fine. What's the difficulty? We're happy. Come, join me, have a bottle. You don't realize how happy I am. Here you're struggling to make money, you're struggling to work. What's the point of all this struggle? When you can get happiness so easily, just keep enough money to buy a bottle and you're happy. Someone in the mode of passion, he's satisfied. There's some happiness. Prabhupada is saying there's some mental happiness to this idea, I have a house, I have a bank balance, I have so much now, I'm going to get more later. Planning and scheming, yes, making plans for the future. There's satisfaction in that. But each mode, the happiness is higher than the previous mode. So for someone in the mode of passion, the mode of ignorance looks miserable. They think, my God, how can anyone be happy like this? For someone in the mode of goodness, the mode of passion looks miserable. Look at how hard they work. And what are they getting for it? After working all day, all night, they come home to their bed and they fall asleep and they wake up the next morning and commute to work again. What's the happiness here? I remember on the main highway from Oxford to London, it's called the M40. And it's like the interstate I-40, you know, like I-95. There's a big fence that kind of separates two farmers' lands. It's just mostly countryside as you go through the drive. And it's a wooden fence, and someone on that fence has painted, it's a long fence and it's right in front of this, so the highway goes like this and the fence is like this. And someone's painted in big letters, why do you do this every day? Because there's people who live in Oxford and they work in London, or they live in London and work in Oxford, or somewhere in between, right? Every day. Why do you do this every day? It's a question from the mode of goodness to the mode of passion. The mode of goodness is asking the mode of passion, why do you do this every day? The person in the mode of passion, that cannot stop to think. He's like, oh my God, I got to get to work, got to get to work, you know. Why? Because I got to make money, oh my God. Like, and then someone asks him, why do you do this every day? And all of a sudden the mode of goodness might be awakened. Maybe someone is, oh my God, why am I doing this every day? Yeah, why? This is crazy. I'm spending an hour in the car, up and down the motorway, every single day. There must be a better way of doing this. So maybe it will awaken the mode of goodness in someone. But usually not. It's usually just a little flicker. Someone thinks, oh, that's a good question. But then, oh my God, it's time for work, let's keep going. And the mode of goodness is squashed before it has time to manifest. Because they're not feeding the mode of goodness, they're feeding the mode of passion.
How would one move from one mode to another? Say if you were in a mode of ignorance and you wanted or you chose to make a move, how do you go about doing that?
Very, very good question. Very excellent question. Basically, you put yourself in circumstances, in a situation that is filled with that mode which you want to go into. So, in other words, we have all three modes in us. It's just a matter of extracting the right one and feeding it, making it, nourishing that mode. So, say you want to move from the mode of passion to the mode of goodness. So, you try to surround yourself with activities, with the atmosphere, with the situation which is conducive to the mode of goodness. That we can figure out by reading Bhagavad Gita. We can figure out what things are in the mode of goodness, what things, right? And most importantly, you surround yourself by people who are in the mode that you want to cultivate. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that association is the most powerful factor which develops or determines what mode you're in. So, sangat sanjayate kama. From sangha, from association, a particular type of desire is developed. So, for example, Krishna says there's food in the three modes of material nature. If we want to elevate ourselves from the mode of ignorance, to the mode of passion, to the mode of goodness, then the first thing we have to do is to change our habits. So Prabhupada is saying mode of ignorance food is, Krishna says in Gita also, right, is meat products. These are a result of violence, and they're decomposed, and they're putrid, and unhealthy, and so forth. So they're a mode of ignorance. If we want to cultivate the mode of goodness, then we read, okay, what's the food appropriate to mode of goodness? And say, okay, this is what it is, right? And say, okay, I'm going to take this food. Or what's the kind of activity, what's the kind of work conducive to the mode of goodness? Aha, here's the type of work. I should do honest labor in a way that's not over-endeavor, not too much more than what I need, right? That type, okay, I'll do this. What type of charity should I give? What type of sacrifice should I do? What type of association should I... All these things we'll read in the Gita as we go on. The elements are described, which are conducive to this. Rising early, certain times of the day. Like I said, everything in this world is made of the mode of goodness, passion, ignorance. The sun, the moon, the stars, the times of day, the earth, everything is. So you just, you take out your guidebook, and you figure out, these are the things which are in the mode of goodness. I want to cultivate this mood, let's surround myself by this. Certain times of the day are in certain modes. The early morning hours are in the mode of goodness. The late night hours are in the mode of ignorance. The daytime is usually in the mode of passion. So if we want to cultivate the mode of goodness, for example, then you rise early. And naturally that mood helps to nourish the mode of goodness that you've received in the mode of passion. So basically by association, by cultivating the right type of atmosphere and surrounding ourselves with the right type of people for the mode we want to work on. Yeah, very good question.
I guess Krishna says to Arjuna, this is your duty, being a Kshatriya, to fight, and there, like Arjuna is being told we have to number of passion for doing duty.
Yes.
So, I mean, is he, you said, you know, Krishna still the equilibrium. So, I mean, Arjuna was coming from that passion to the more of goodness. And then, you know, again, he goes back to passion.
Right.
To do his duty.
Okay.
How do you explain that?
Very good question. So, Krishna, yes, he's asking Arjuna to fight. And that's in the mode of a passion, right? Now, that's true, because Krishna is saying that you are by nature, you're a kshatriya. And a kshatriya is one who is in the mode of passion. So whether you like it or not, this is the point we read from chapter 3, you will be forced to act in that manner. You can go to the forest if you like, but even there, you'll become, I don't know, the head of the forest tribe, you know, and you'll start ruling the forest people. It's your nature. This is what you will do, whether you like it or not. So he says, acknowledge the fact that you're in the mode of passion. Do that activity, but do it as a matter of duty. Offer the results of your activities to me. And in that way, you can transcend not the mode of passion or the mode of goodness or the mode of ignorance, but the modes of nature altogether. You can transcend this material world. Because, this is the point we were getting to, is all three modes of nature, goodness is better than passion is better than ignorance, but all three modes of material nature cause bondage. They keep us tied, they're all ropes. Right? So it's like someone has maximum security in a prison, someone has medium security, someone has very light security or is on parole. But all three are bound. So from the perspective of someone who's in maximum security, the person who's in low security, he's really well off, he has a lot of freedom. And from the perspective of someone who's in minimum security, the person in maximum security is very miserable, he's very stuck. But from the perspective of someone who's free, who's outside the prison system, all three of them are pretty bad. All three of them are losers. They're not fit, and they don't fit in society. So from the perspective of the devotee or the one who's transcendental, all three of them, even the one who's in the mode of goodness, is stuck. In other words, we receive a particular mode of nature, we accept that material mode, say, okay, this is what I have. We act within that mode of nature, perform our duty within that mode, but through acting in that mode, we try to elevate ourselves and find release. So it is through that mode of nature. So someone in the mode of passion uses the mode of passion to do his duty, to elevate himself to the point where he's free of the modes of material nature. And this is what Krishna will say in chapter 18. He says, every man can find perfection by the performance of his own duty according to his nature. So Arjuna, he was actually not going from the mode of passion to the mode of goodness. He was actually descending to the mode of ignorance. Because, you see, what are the basic qualities of the three modes of nature? The mode of goodness illuminates everything. You see things as they are. The mode of passion, you see things as they are, and you see how everything, you see the unity in everything. You see how everything is actually being controlled by the Supreme Lord. It's all part of the Lord's energy, and therefore everything is connected. Everything is united. All living entities are the same spiritual nature, the material energy, the spiritual energy, the individual. You see everything united in the Supreme Lord. This is mode of goodness. You see things as they are because there's light, there's knowledge, the light of knowledge. The mode of passion, you still see everything, but you see differences, dualities everywhere. In other words, you see this is my friend, this is my enemy. It's hot, it's cold, it's light, it's dark. This is happiness, this is suffering. I need this, I don't have this. I'm hankering, I'm lamenting. You see things, but everything is a mode of duality. Everything's in opposites. So there's flux, always, up and down, tension. The mode of ignorance is actually very similar to the mode of goodness, in that you see everything unified. You see the unity in everything, but it's a result of not seeing anything. So it's like when everything becomes dark, it becomes nighttime, then everything becomes one, right? Everything becomes unified. But it's because you can't see anything. So you end up bumping into something, or stubbing your toe. So the person in the mode of ignorance, this is his problem, is that he's bumping into things, he's stumbling over everything, because he has his eyes closed, everything is dark for him. So in some sense, the mode of ignorance, mode of goodness are very close, they're very parallel. But one is a result of knowledge, and the other is a result of a lack of knowledge. Yeah.
In explaining how the purpose in Prabhupada, it seems, you know, Arjuna, he's a devotee, he has qualities, that's why he sees, you know, I don't want to hurt anyone, and I mean, it's kind of explaining his, you know, more, you know, succinct, you know, he's a kind of devotee, that's why he's seeing this, and that's why he doesn't want to fight.
Both explanations are given, yes. Arjuna's lamentation is ignorant. Krishna says this the first thing in Gita. He says, Ashochan and Vashochastam Prak. You're speaking learned words, but actually you don't know the basic thing. So he's ignorant, right? However, the point is also made, Prabhupada also makes the point that in some sense it's kind of the impetus or the source of that ignorance, his compassion or his lamentation, is actually, in a funny way, ironically, it's derived from the fact that he's a devotee. Like some people are ignorant, most people are ignorant, and are attached to the world, to their family, to their friends, like that, because they're attached to the body, and it's a very sort of gross attachment. But Arjuna, he was being attached because he was naturally soft-hearted. So yes, it was a compassionate, the compassionate quality was a result of his being a devotee, but it was misdirected. And because it was misdirected, it was actually ignorance, you see. So the source was okay, it was a nice cause, you know, the reason for it was good, he was a devotee. But it wasn't aimed in the right direction, it was misdirected, and therefore it ended up, you know, turning into ignorance. Right? He didn't see things as they are.
Yeah. I think there's like two things that I get confused about. Is there's the, like Moses work, where you have your Shudra or Shakti or Dhamma or Vashi, and that can be changed. Or there's like Moses nature, but like Richard was talking about, where, or what you were talking before, where someone in the mode of ignorance is drinking, and how can that person move up to the mode of passion, and how can the passion person move up to the mode of goodness and be peaceful. But the Shudra who's in the mode of ignorance doesn't mean necessarily that he's drinking. So there's, so for example, Arjuna's mode of passion cannot be changed, but at the same time, it's possible that he could have, you know, not be hankering and not be.
In other words, the work you do is in the three modes of nature, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the person doing that work is engrossed by that mode. It's a nice point. That Prabhupada says a devotee can perform the activities of a Shudra if necessary. You know, he can do hard labor, he can do the activities of a Kshatriya, of a Brahman, of a Vaishya, whatever. It doesn't mean necessarily that he's in that mode. Although, there is correlation between them. Right? So when Arjuna's performing the activities of a Kshatriya, he does have to also make use of the qualities of a Kshatriya to some extent. Right? He has to employ anger, and he has to speak harsh words to his opponents, and he has to feel like a controller and powerful. Right? He cannot be too humble and like that. You know? So there's some relation, but it's a good point that it's not necessarily that they're completely tied. You know, they're completely unified. Yes.
We've talked about this before. You can have the activities, and then from the outside we could see it look like they're the same, but one's intent inside can be in the mode of ignorance.
Yes. Yes.
Or passion. Or goodness.
Yes. Yes. Or transcendental.
Or transcendental.
Yes. This is a very good point, right? This is what Krishna is exactly asking Arjuna. He's saying the activity you're doing is in the mode of passion because you've received a body that is in the mode of passion. You're a kshatriya, right? You've received a psychology which is in the mode of passion. But, he's saying, do that as an offering to me. In other words, the motivation behind it is a transcendental motivation. Because the individual is not neither his mind nor is he the body. He's neither his psychological makeup, neither his psychological makeup has anything to do with him, nor his physical body. The individual is the spirit soul, and he's transcendental. So what Krishna's telling him, that because of your psychology and because of your body, you will be forced to act in a particular way. Fine, do that, but remember that you, the spirit soul, are independent. You're transcendental. So your reasons for doing it have to be transcendental. In other words, do them for me. That's an excellent point. This is similar to what Gopal was saying also. Right? That the individual, when he realizes his identity as a servant of Krishna, can extract himself from the mode, even though his body and his mind may be performing an activity. In other words, if you've received a body and mind in a particular mode of nature, there's not so much you can do about changing that. You can purify it, but there's not so much you can do. However, the individual himself, by cultivating transcendental knowledge, can realize, I have nothing to do with my body, I have nothing to do with my mind, although they have to work in a particular way, but I don't have to be attached to them. I can do it from a position of transcendence. I can do it for the right purposes, for Krishna.
Isn't the Bhagavad-gita is like Arjuna allows and he surrenders to Krishna. He does his duty as a satriya, but he's acting in the mode of passion, but he transcends the whole thing.
Yes, yes, exactly. This is the message of the Gita. This is precisely the message.
It depends on what your act is in determines what mode you are. So there's nothing as a total person in goodness. And because everyone sleeps, So very second part of ignorance in the life, no matter what you are, as a human being.
Right. So that's a good point. There is a point of pure goodness, and that pure goodness is actually the same thing as transcendental. The point is that in the material world, you'll never find pure goodness. Like Krishna saying in this verse 10, it's always mixed by the mode of passion and ignorance. No matter how good of a person you are, there will be some tinge of passion and ignorance there, no doubt. You can do nothing about it. However, if you transcend this mode of material nature, right, that is the position of pure goodness. Pure goodness means that you are no longer in the material world, because in the material world you cannot have pure goodness. You see? In the material world there is no pure goodness. Therefore, if you have pure goodness, by definition, you're transcendental. This is called Shuddha Sattva. Sattvam Vishuddham Vasudeva Shadditam. This position of Shuddha Sattva is known as the state of Vasudev. This is a transcendental platform. And one who is a pure devotee of the Lord, even though he may act as though he's within the other modes of nature, right? We read about this in chapter 3. He may act as like everyone else is acting, but actually he's situated on the position, on the transcendental position of Shuddha Sattva. And he may even sleep, for example. It's not the activity of sleeping itself which is in the mode of ignorance. It's the lack of knowledge. When you fall asleep, what happens? You become completely ignorant. You lose any perception, consciousness. You lose your knowledge. But the person who's on the transcendental platform, even his sleeping is not a lack of knowledge. It's not a lack of consciousness. He's not overcome by the mode of ignorance, even there. Like, you find people who... For example, you see advanced devotees, like when they sleep, as soon as you, the servants of Srila Prabhupada would see this, for example. He would sleep, say, 2 hours a night. Just enough, because the physical body needs a little rest. It's like turning your car off so it doesn't overheat when you're driving too much. Right? So you need to turn it off for a while. So he'd sleep to keep the body and soul together. But there was no lack of consciousness there. It wasn't that he was achieving any enjoyment from the act of sleeping. You know, like when we sleep, then we kind of, it's a very enjoyable activity. You fall asleep, you feel very good, and you sleep soundly, and then you wake up and you go, oh, this is so good, let's sleep for a little bit while. You know, it's kind of, and you bury your head in your pillow and you think, oh, a little bit more, you know. Why? You're awake, but you still want to go back into the ignorance, right? You naturally, your eyes open, but you don't want to get out of bed. Why? Because you're finding the mode of ignorance enjoyable. That means that you're in the mode of ignorance. A pure devotee, on the other hand, you see someone like Srila Prabhupada, he sleeps the absolute minimum necessary to keep the body and soul together, because the body requires certain things. And as soon as the eyes open, he's completely there. He's up and out of bed. The consciousness is completely crystal clear. It means he never lost his position of consciousness. He never lost his awareness. It was only a temporary turning off of the engine to let the car recover. So there's a difference even in sleep itself. It's severely in the mode of passion, isn't it? Like the mind is, you know, overworking, churning, even in the sleep. Yeah. I mean, the mind is still, it's churning, it's still working. The mode of passion is still present, even in sleep. You see, it's still and great mathematicians and people like that. You know, the walls next to their bed be covered in formulas and stuff, because they wake up in the middle of the night. You know, suddenly they realize the formula before, scroll it down, you know, and before they forget and go back to sleep again. In the morning they wake up and it's there. It's a fact, actually. Great thinkers, they used to, the walls next to their bed were covered in writing, in handwriting. The mind is still active.
He was sitting outside, and he was like, Prabhupada's sleeping, and he said, how could a spiritual master sleep? He's not supposed to sleep. And he was having this doubt, because scripture says, you know, sleep. As soon as he was thinking that, Prabhupada just went to his side, said, I'm like, what are you doing, you know?
Yeah. You know, like, completely aware.
Yeah, he was fully aware that this person was thinking like that.
Mm. There's another nice story I can give you of Jayadvaita Swami. He's one of the senior disciples of Srila Prabhupada in ISKCON. Very, very strict and very nice sannyasi. He has very few disciples, six total. And one of them is Kadambakanana Swami, who's now, he's a sannyasi and has his own disciples. So kind of his disciples have disciples. Anyhow, Kadambakanana Swami was saying that once he was in Vrindavan and he saw Jayadvaita Swami going past the Vrindavan temple courtyard, and he had a big plate of Mahaprasadam with him. And he said, "Come, come," you know, and he pulled him over, and he brought him to his room, and they both divided up the Mahaprasadam, big, huge plate, you know, and it's like eight and eight. It's like, wow, amazing, you know. And then Maharaj wanted to sleep, right? Okay, let's see. Will please? He asked Kadambakanana Swami. He said, "Will you please read me Krishna book while I fall asleep?" So he said, "Okay, I'll fall asleep." Now you can say, kind of, this is the typical pattern for one in the mode of ignorance, right? So eat a lot and you know, sleep. But he said he was reading Krishna book and he was kind of reciting. And after about 5 minutes, you know, Maharaj was completely out. You know, so he thought, okay, and he closed the book, right? As soon as he stopped, closed the book, he said, "Huh? Why you stop reading? Keep reading." I said, "Oh, sorry, sorry, Maharaj." And he keeps reading, you know. And then about 5 minutes later, again, you know, and he thinks, "I should keep reading." And so he keeps reading. And after about 10 minutes, he said, "Okay, Maharaj is completely gone, completely out." He starts closing the book. And as soon as he starts reading, immediately Maharaj, "Huh? Why you stop reading?" You know. And he's like constantly there immediately, you know. And this happens 3 times before he becomes so frightened that he just keeps reading the whole time for 1 hour while he reads, you know. And the point being, he didn't, I mean, he was snoring and he was in sleep and everything, but he never became dead, you know, he never became stupid and unaware like we normally become after a big meal, you know. Just, that sloth, that lethargy, that ignorance was never there. Even though, yes, the body had to sleep, but the consciousness was always there, it was clear. Because the consciousness is independent of the body. It's connected, it's in some sense stuck, but it's still independent. So it's possible, you know. You see someone in the mode of pure goodness, and that's the transcendental person, in other words. And everything, all their qualities, their activities are very different. In fact, that's exactly what Arjuna is going to ask in the next verse we'll read, in the next 2 verses. He'll say, you know, what is the qualities of someone who's in this transcendental platform? In the future sections, you'll ask this. What is the quality of one who is in the mode of pure goodness? How does he walk? How does he sit? How does he behave? In the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that one who is on the platform of transcendental realization, of transcendence, Brahma Bhuta Prasannatma, he's on the transcendental platform. He says he has 2 qualities, na shochati, na kankshati. He doesn't lament and he doesn't hanker. Sama sarvesha bhuteshu, and he sees all living entities equally. So he says, one who is on the transcendental platform. Now, we were saying that the transcendental platform means it is the platform of pure goodness, right? Goodness that is not mixed with passion and ignorance. Now, you just look at this verse and you see this is exactly what Krishna is saying. One who is on the platform of Brahman, he's in the platform of pure goodness. Why? What is the quality of goodness that we said? Well, we said goodness itself is when everything becomes illuminated by knowledge, so you see the unity in everything. Right? So what does Krishna say in the 3rd line? He says, Sama Sarvesha Bhuteshu. He sees all living entities equally. Right? So that condition is fulfilled. Secondly, he says, Na Shochati Na Kangshati. That person doesn't hanker and he doesn't lament. Now, hankering, that is a trademark quality of a person in which mode? Passion. He's always looking for something. And lamenting is the trademark quality of the person in ignorance. The person in the mode of passion is constantly making plans because he constantly wants things. I want this, I want this. And he has ambitions and hopes and desires. And therefore, the person in the mode of passion is always living in the future. Something I can gain in the future. The person on the mode of ignorance, rather, he's constantly lamenting, I lost that. Oh, if only that had turned out this way. If only I had done that. You know, and he's lamenting constantly. So he's living in the past. The person in the mode of passion is living in the future. The person in the mode of ignorance is living in the past. And the person in the mode of goodness is?
Present.
Living in the present. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he makes a very important point about this. He says, the only place of happiness, the only place of happiness in the material world is in the mode of goodness. That's the only place where you can actually be somewhat satisfied, is in the mode of goodness. And the mode of goodness means you're living in the present. You're always, in other words, the point being, if you're always looking for something or you're always lamenting for something, you can never be happy. But if you're satisfied with what you have, and what does that mean, being satisfied with what you have? That you are satisfied in the present. Then you're in the mode of goodness. Now, here's the kind of the punchline, right? Here's the kind of the crux of the thing. This is the goal, being satisfied in the present. Being satisfied with what you have in the present. But what is it that you have in the present? What is the only thing that you have in the present? How can you be satisfied in the present? What can make you satisfied in the present? What do you have to be satisfied with in the present?
Transcendental.
Yes, but I mean, the goal is I want to be satisfied with what I have. I want to be satisfied in the present. What do I have in the present? Yes. But what the point is, the only thing you have in the present is yourself and your relationship with Krishna,
right,
with the Supreme Self, the Atma and the Paramatma. Everything else you don't actually have in the present. Suppose you say, I want to be satisfied now. So I'll be satisfied with the car I have and the house I have. But tomorrow you may lose the car, and tomorrow you may lose the house, right? So then how can you remain satisfied with the car and the house? What will you do when you lose it? Means there's nothing constant there to be satisfied with. There's nothing you can actually hold on to. The only thing you have that's always there with you in the present. The point is, you have to remain in a position of complete steadiness, right? Of satisfaction. But the only thing you always have in the present tense is Krishna, is your relationship with Krishna. Therefore, being in the mode of goodness, by definition, it logically follows that you have to be engaged in devotional service to be in the mode of goodness, purely in the mode of goodness. Anything else, you will always look for the future. If you want to be satisfied with something material, you cannot be, because that thing may disappear, and then you'll be forced. Your equilibrium will be damaged. Exactly. Therefore, mode of goodness cannot be based upon any material object, because a material object it has a point of beginning. It didn't exist in the past. It exists for some time, and it won't exist in the future. So something that goes in and out of existence like that will be tied to the future and will be tied to the past. So if you base your life, if you base your attachment on something like that, then you are bound to go up and down with that object, right? So if you base your attachment on a car, then when the car goes out of existence, you're bound to lament. And when you receive it, you're bound to be happy. But if you make the basis of your life Krishna, then Krishna or your Krishna consciousness, our relationship with Krishna, is the only thing that doesn't go in and out of existence. It's the only thing that's not tied to the past and it's not tied to the future. It's always there in the present. And therefore, someone who's in the mode of goodness, in pure goodness, will be engaged in devotional service. And this is the last line of that verse. Sama sarvesha bhuteshu mad bhaktim labhate param. When someone is not hankering, when he's not lamenting, when he sees everyone equally, in other words, when he's in the mode of goodness, then what happens? he engages himself in my devotional service. That's the natural, that's the logical consequence. You have no other choice in the mode of pure goodness. I'm sorry, someone had a question. Yes.
Yeah, you were mentioning situation or something material. So essentially what you're characterizing is the absolute. Mm-hmm. There has to be an absolute,
yes,
in the present in order to be fixed in this mode of goodness or,
yes,
pure goodness. So it's not transitory.
Yes.
But what you're saying, though, is you mentioned there is only from material time, there is this concept of past, present, future.
Mm.
So factually, there's still this consistency or absoluteness that's happening. Because if you think about, oh, this is what I did in my service yesterday, that's absolute. This is the hankering that I have for the service that I'm going to do tomorrow. That's also absolute.
Mm.
So this concept of past and future absolutely becomes a continuum.
Yes.
So there's no change.
Yes.
So you move beyond the sense of past or future.
Yes.
Everything you think only in terms of the present.
Yes.
So tomorrow I shall do service. 10 years ago I did service.
Yes.
And you thread all those things.
When I go back to God, I'll also do service.
I'll be doing service. So everything. So there's no change. So this also connects to what you were saying. This point of pure goodness, when we actually transcend, we see things. So this whole idea of suffering, connection with the body, actually ceases.
Yes, yes, that's very well put. This is the point. It's the absolute position. It's the only, that devotional service is the only constant string that moves through the past, present, and future. Our life is divided into the past, present, and future. But the one thing that remains throughout is our devotional service, and therefore it's actually not the past, present, and future, it's actually the present, it's absolute. In other words, God is the only entity who lives eternally in the present. For God, everything is one everlasting moment of the present, because he's beyond time, right? So you cannot speak of past and you cannot speak of future in relation to God, because there's no time there. So when we ourselves want to come to that point of being present, eternally in the present, then we have to connect ourselves to God. That's the only thing we can actually, only platform we can find, which is timeless. It's eternally present.
We hear about the Atma and eternal Atma. The Atma also cannot be cleaved and wet and swollen and so forth and so on. So it's also has a continuing this.
Yes.
But yet, so what you're saying is not that we, in order to get outside of these three modes, is the point, right? Because that Atma also continues.
Mm.
So the if we want to get outside of the three modes with all the suffering and sickness, old age, etc., then we have to follow the dictate of the paradigm, right?
Mm. Yes, yes. I mean, the thing is, actually, the Atma is of the same quality as the Paramatma, right? So, coming on this point of transcendence, transcending the modes of nature, actually means getting in touch with who you really are. It means realizing your own nature. In effect, what you're saying, it's not something that we actually have to achieve. It's not something we have to get. We are that. We are transcendental by nature. The Atma is transcendental, it's spiritual in quality. But it's identified with a past, present, future situation. It's identified with a changing world, with a world in flux. And it thinks this is who I am, right? Because it's identified with the body. But as soon as we break that conception and we say, no, this is who I really am, right? Then what do I do? What is my identity? Oh, it's in relation to the Paramatma, it's in relation to the person sitting next to me. And this relationship is what actually lasts. It's what actually I have to hold on to. And you find this in practical life also. You find this in one's practice of Krishna consciousness. That kind of regardless, for a devotee, regardless of what ups and downs his life may go through, what difficulties, what problems, which you know, hankering, lamenting, future, the memories of the past, the difficulties of the future, whatever a devotee might go through. But he is able to get through all this because he realizes that what I have constantly with me is my relationship with Krishna. That thing will never change. That quality will never change. And so it's possible, you actually realize, you know, in chanting your rounds, you're doing your sadhana, you get up in the morning, and you realize this is something that will be with me always, no matter what situation I'm in my life, no matter how changed the circumstances become. But this is something that no one can ever take away from me. No one can ever take away my relationship with Krishna. The holy names, my service to Krishna, my sadhana, my rising early in the morning, my singing, my dancing, my chanting. How can anyone take these things away? As long as I have these things, I'm happy, I'm satisfied. This is the rope that I hold on to my life. This is what's constant. And therefore, regardless of what's happening to me externally, regardless of all the onslaughts that material nature may throw upon us, all the different difficult situations she may put us in, the devotee is able to go through these in a transcendental way because he realizes this flux will come and pass, the storm will come and pass, but what I hold on to is my relationship with Krishna, and that's eternal, that's eternally in the present. And it's a fact. Can anyone take that away from you? Can anyone take the chanting of the holy name away from you? No, they cannot. You can be completely penniless on the street and still you will have that with you.
Is it not conditional also to have the holy name?
Conditional in what sense?
The chanting the holy name is also conditional, right? And you chant the holy name and your condition, you know, to follow a few things are, you know, the holy name should be given to you by someone, so it's based on conditions.
No, in fact, the holy name is not based on any conditions. This is second verse of Shikshastaka, Nam Nam, Akari, Bahudani, just said, Niyamita Smarane Nakala. There's no conditions upon the holy name because it's directly Krishna. Right? However, there are certain circumstances which are favorable for chanting the holy name. They make the effect come out nicer, they make it powerful, they allow us to access it better. Because just like we were saying earlier with Richard's question, right, that if you want to cultivate the mode of goodness, if you want to cultivate the transcendental position, then you should create circumstances and atmosphere which is conducive towards it. Right? So leading a particular lifestyle, following certain rules and regulations, doing a minimum number of rounds, all these things are favorable towards cultivating that position. So you can actually remain in that transcendental post. You can be steady in it. But the name itself is not... it's not conditioned by anything. The only problem is that we go up and down. Sometimes we come to the platform of transcendental realization and then we sink again. It's like we're being thrown in this ocean of material existence. And once in a while, the waves throw us and we get our head above water and we go, you know, and then we're underwater again. We're dunking again. So the idea is, the holy name is there, it's transcendental. But we can't maintain that level. We have periods of where we feel, yes, I'm connected to Krishna, yes, I'm transcendental, yes. But then it doesn't last. So how to make it last? How to make that position permanent? For that, we have to create a circumstance. We have to create a support system so that when we do fall, someone can catch us. This is the purpose of devotional life, is that we create an atmosphere where there's a net so we don't fall. We don't fall very far, at least. We can pick ourselves up again. So the average amount of time we spend above water is increased that way. That's the idea behind the rule of regulation. It's basically to condition us. It doesn't actually condition the holy name, if you see what I mean. The holy name is there transcendental, but we're the ones who we need to condition ourselves, so it's favorable.
What about the condition of the devotees?
The what?
The condition of the devotees.
Uh-huh.
That's not lamentation for anything material. It's not a lamentation for what's lost in this material world. One time, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he asked Ramananda Rai that what is the greatest misery in this world? And Ramananda Rai answered that it is separation from the devotee of the Lord. Losing the association of the devotee of the Lord is the greatest misery in this material world. It's the greatest misery, full stop. And that kind of lamentation, the devotee's lamentation, say for the association of another devotee, that's not lamenting because anything is lost for oneself. That is lamentation that is centered upon Krishna. That's lamentation that's the gopi's lamentation for the, after losing the association of Krishna. That's because it's completely centered upon Krishna. It's not touched by this material world. The basic definition of Krishna, of God, is that he's completely transcendental, beyond the three modes of material nature. So both lamentation and hankering, in fact, have a position in the spiritual world. They have a transcendental position. So a devotee, what does he hanker after? We read that the quality of the mode of passion is that it produces greed, right? A devotee is also greedy, lobha. But that greed, what is the greed the devotee has? For more and more sadhu sangha, for more and more association of the devotees. That type of greed is liberating. Lamentation upon losing the association of the devotee, that type of lamentation is liberating. Because it's not tied to this material world, it's centered upon Krishna. Krishna is at the center of that hankering, lamentation.
Prabhupada uses the example of being bitten by a snake, and then he also used the snake venom to liberate that person's malady. So we probably fall into that.
Yeah. The same thing can be, yes, exactly. Or heating and cooling, right, Prabhupada says. The expert engineer knows how to turn a heater into a cooler because it's the same energy, right? But that same energy can be used to heat or to cool. So the same activities, the same qualities in this material world, which are heating us and cooking us in this material world, burning us, they can be also used to cool us. It's the same. The energy of the sun heats us. But that same energy reflected off the moon, it cools us, right? It's the same energy. So the substance is the same, because everything is the energy of the Lord. Everything is coming from the Lord. So there's no good and evil, so to speak. There's no polarities, because the Lord is the all in all. There's nothing in competition with the Lord. It's just a matter of connecting something to the Lord. When things become disconnected from the Lord, then they become the material world. They become the three modes of material nature. These same three modes of material nature, when they're connected to the Lord, they have a presence in the spiritual world. The three modes of material nature in the material world are called sattva, rajas, and tamas. In the spiritual world, these same qualities are reflected as sat, chit, and ananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss. The spiritual world is composed of this. What is, just like the material world, the substance, the stuff of the material world is goodness, passion, and ignorance. So the stuff of the spiritual world, what is the spiritual world made of? Eternity, knowledge, and bliss. So those same qualities are present in this material world and the spiritual world. Is one time they're connected to Krishna and one time they're not. So when the gopis lament, they come closer to Krishna. When we lament, we come farther from Krishna. When the gopis hanker, they hanker for Krishna. When we hanker for our senses. So that's the only difference. The material world is disconnected from Krishna, the spiritual world is connected to Krishna. But the substance is actually the same. It's all coming from Krishna. It's all his energy.
Yes. When initially when Lord plays for and then still the father may commit with the Prakriti came into existence or something. So souls were already there in material world and being in equilibrium, and then the stealing process actually has put the souls in the material world.
No, actually Krishna's glance impregnates the material energy. So he puts the souls in the material energy through his glance.
So even before the souls were there are these modes existing in this material world.
Yeah, the modes are kind of like a dead blob, you know. Mm-hmm.
And Krishna, by his glance, he agitates the blobs and drops the living entities within them. So it's actually the presence, you see, it's the presence of the spirit soul which causes the modes to be active. Why? Because the modes are made of matter. The mature blob is made of matter, and matter by nature is inert, it's dead. So on their own, they just kind of, they lie there. Nothing's going to, in other words, you have the primordial soup, but nothing's going to pop out of the primordial soup unless you inject it with life. So when Krishna glances, he stirs it up. How? By injecting the living entities into it. And it's the spirit soul that is active, right? Where does, it's basically the desires which create activity in the three modes of nature. But where do desires come from? They come from something living. Matter doesn't have any desires, right? So it's the living entities themselves, their agitation, their desires, cause this peaceful blob to start changing, to start
does
acting.
The non-living entities also are said to be in certain mode?
Like, you mean like stones and...
Yeah.
Yes, they're also made of this modes of nature, right? But they'll lie there, just like a rock will lie there in the mode of ignorance, unless a living entity takes it and does something with it. You can make a building out of it or throw it on someone or whatever. Right? So, yes, everything is made of that, but it'll kind of, you know, kind of sit there till we activate it. We are the activating principle. Krishna says this in Gita. He says, "Aparayam itastvanyam praktim vidhi me param jiva bhuta mahabaho yayedam dharyate jagat." That beyond the material modes of nature, beyond this material world, there is a higher energy which is made of jiva bhuta mahabaho, which is made of these living entities who are yayedam dharyate jagat. These living entities are exploiting the material energy. We are the ones that cause the material energy to become, to take on these different shapes and forms because of our desires. We're the activating principle.
And so what you just said is an ancient way of saying it, and that's also how the my knowledge of it, like quantum, just says the same thing you just said in the modern physics, right? Theoretical.
There has to be something injected into it.
Right. The intent and the involvement of the experience.
Unfortunately, scientific cosmology doesn't follow suit, you know. It's the basic question is, you have the primordial soup, and then at some point there's enough complexity in the soup that life emerges. This is the basic idea. But the point we're making here is that no matter how complex the soup is, it's going to lie there unless you inject the life force in it, unless the active element is not there, right? So this is, basically the Mahatattva at the beginning, the three modes of nature is a primordial soup. And Krishna then injects us into it, which causes it to come to life. That's kind of the missing link of science, you know. It's kind of say, where does that principle of consciousness come in? What they want to say is that things just become complex enough where consciousness pops out. But that's basically what it's saying is, we don't know how it pops out.
They don't have God and they don't have Krishna. And that's everything.
Yeah. There's now, among cosmologists, there's this theory coming of intelligent design. It's really becoming popular. It's not exactly a Christian idea of creator, but at least the good quality that it has is that it acknowledges that you need some outside mover, so to speak, to get things rolling, intelligent design, who fine-tunes things enough to get things moving. And it's becoming actually very popular. It's like a rage on college campuses and stuff. It's becoming very popular.
So the non-living entities, like, I don't know, I remember in some discussion that there is living entities whose consciousness is turned off in the matter. Is that true? I mean, if we say non-living on the timer, there is, I remember when we talked about what was non-living, someone said it's there's soul in there, but consciousness turned off.
Yeah, like I've heard it said that even like rocks and things have living entities in them. But they're just so dullified and just so that there's practically no appearance of consciousness. So that's possible. I I've heard that as well. I can't confirm it, but the idea being that everything is ultimately a product of consciousness, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's the fact that there are microorganisms, even when you dig up soil or sedimentary rock or fossilized rock, there are living entities there. And of course, not to speak of the protons, neutrons, the passing through rocks, so there's always some kind of microscopic level of some activity, even if you pull. The silly idea of going to the moon and getting rocks, and then they break the rocks down and they do whatever testing pH value of the soil and the rock or having, they find these microorganisms that are in there. So it's a sub-universe that we can't see with the naked eye. So there are all types of living entities that would be there, even in things that, you know, just discovering living entities and blood, and they discovered that in the 20th
century. I mean, like you're saying, even you can say kind of just bare elements, dead matter, is active, very much active at the atomic level. It means the electrons are spinning at, you know, some amazingly fast speed, and they're, like you're saying, protons and neutrons are being exchanged, and things are, the walls of the atom are porous, basically, things can go in and out. And that kind of activity is there. And of course, we understand that that activity is present because of the presence of the Supersoul. The Paramatma is, Supersoul is present in every atom of this material world. Andantarastha Paramanu Chayantarastham. Even Paramanu, even in the smallest of the atom, the Paramatma is present. It's you know that at the Science of Self-Realization, you've seen the hardcover book, in the front there's this painting of Vishnu, four hands, and there's the electrons spinning around him, and he's basically at the heart of the atom. And that's basically the way it is. The Shastra described that even at the heart of the Paramanu, of the atom, the Lord is present as the Paramatma. And because of his presence, that atom is actually able to exist. Meaning everything would, the whole thing would simply disintegrate. It would just collapse, the whole material world, if the Lord were not holding up every single little piece of it. Because as it is, matter has no capability of supporting itself. Same word, yayedam dharyate jagat, Krishna says. Dharyate means exploiting, but it also means supporting. It's the spiritual energy which is supporting the material world. You remove the spiritual energy and the whole thing collapses like a house of cards. There's nothing left in the material world. It's poof, it's gone. And therefore, essentially, in that sense, everything is conscious. Because the Lord is present at the root of everything, every atom. Therefore, even a rock will be conscious, right? But it's just so covered up, that consciousness, and so that you don't perceive it.
That point being, in the spiritual world, if you consider rocks, actually what we see here is the opposite, where there is this inactivity, you see actually activity in rocks, and these things we consider to be non-living.
Yep. In the spiritual world, the rocks melt from joy when Krishna plays his flute, right? You see rocks skipping and dancing, you know. Yeah, Krishna's here.
Flintstones.
That's a nice point. This is the difference between material world and spiritual world. Everything there is made of chintamani, which is everything's alive in the spiritual world, every atom, every step.
When they say Krishna is there with every atom, people ask me, does that mean there are multiple super souls in your body?
As we say,
we are a soul, and then there's one super soul we have in our heart. Like what you said, there is an atomic level, so like you have so many millions of atoms in your body.
At every level, you know? So the point is, if you take one little atom from our body, yes, there's a super soul there, right? But as a collective organism, there's also a super soul here. Now, within, we know our body, the super soul for our body, you can say, he is the collective overseer of our organism, right? But within our organism, we know we have other organisms living within us, parasites, and, you know, we've got relationships with all these things in our body, right? And for each one of them, each one of these parasites and bugs and everything, they have also their own super souls, right? Because they've got their life and they've got their body. So you can kind of, there's different spheres of influence. And we ourselves, this is an important point, are parasites or little organisms in a larger organism. Right? This whole earth planet, and this is where all of the idea of environmentalism comes from, right? This whole earth planet is one big organism. Just like the little bug in our belly is part of the larger organism of our body, so we also are little bugs in this belly of material energy, in this Mother Earth. Right? And there is a supersoul for the Mother Earth as well. For this whole material universe, there's a supersoul. He's called Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. So that Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, he's a supersoul for us and for all of us. Right? But individually also at our level we have, and then you go further down. You know, so at each, kind of each, it's nested, you know, at each level you'll find the supersoul is present. But the way to understand it is not that there's all sorts of little supersouls pasted around us. One time someone asked Prabhupada that. They said, you know, Prabhupada, you see that a pure devotee sees Krishna everywhere. Does that mean when you see that tree that you see Krishna's hanging on different branches and, you know? And Prabhupada said, no, it is not like that. He says, the devotee sees Krishna everywhere means that he sees everything as Krishna's energy. He sees that everything is coming from Krishna, everything is supported by Krishna, and everything is controlled by Krishna. That's what it means. Everything is the energy of the Lord, therefore the Lord is present everywhere. Not that we start imagining ourselves as, you know, I cut my nails and hope. Not like that. Okay.
But at the same time, yeah. I mean, you said it is not there in the tree, you just see the tree in relationship to Krishna, but I mean, it's a fact that there's super soul of this size in our...
No, he's there, but the way to understand it is that because it's his energy, therefore Krishna pervades that object. That he is present in his energy. This is the point. Not that we start confusing the tree for Krishna. This is what I mean. Yeah? You see, Krishna pervades it because it's his energy. That's the idea. Whereas in the spiritual world, it's not that it's his energy. It is Krishna there on his own. Yeah, it's kind of, it's like the sun rays and sun itself. You know, that old example again. The sun rays, the sun is present there, but not that there's a sun globe everywhere, but rather the energy of the sun is flowing there. Okay, we stop there. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.